Constitution of the United States. And what transpired, of course, the Constitution was basically put together because of several things that took place. So we talked about them, one being Shays' Rebellion, another being the plan that had worked out between several states that had differing opinions, and they had decided to come together and amend the Articles of Confederation. The Articles of Confederation were the was the document that basically held our country together for a lengthy period of time. They held our country together following, actually before the Revolutionary War, during the Revolutionary War, and for a period of time following the Revolutionary War. Our nation existed as a confederacy where there is supreme power that rests in the state and the state legislatures and the state governments, as opposed to what we have now as a federal system. But we existed as a confederacy, and there were weaknesses in the Articles of Confederation. Basically, what the individuals did, the 55 individuals who met in Philadelphia at what is now the birthplace of our Constitution, what they did theoretically was treason. The more you read, the more you become convinced of that. They did not have the sanction of the states. They did not have the sanction of the congresses of those individual states. And what they did, they met in secrecy. They boarded up the doors and the windows of Constitution Hall. They didn't allow anybody else in to see what they were doing. And I said all that to say this. I mean, thank the Lord that they did, and thank God we have what we have. But those men themselves were taking a risk to forge the government that we have. And again, they met under the guise of correcting some of the flaws that existed in the Articles of Confederation. From the writings of James Madison, who is acknowledged in American history as the father of our Constitution, and I told you before, Madison basically is the only one that kept any notes. We would have no concept or no idea really of anything that went on at the Constitutional Convention were it not for the journals and diaries kept by James Madison, published around 1830, years after his death. They went into what we basically would consider a closed-the-door session, and no one was allowed in, no one was allowed to know what they were doing. But from the very beginning, it was obvious that these men had not assembled themselves together to change the Articles of Confederation. And while that may have been something that was told to the public, it certainly was never from the beginning the intention that they met for. They met to put together what you and I now know as the Constitution of the United States. I said that again to let you know, sometimes we just think everything just happened perfectly in order, everything was in harmony. That was not the case. These men honestly were in jeopardy of their lives. You can imagine, while our Articles of Confederation were not perhaps the best form of government that we could have, and perhaps they were weak in many aspects, they still were the law of the land. They still were the things that the laws that America functioned under. And when a group of individuals met with the idea, explicit idea, of overturning those ideas, overturning that rule, that's treason. And so what these men were doing, had history worked another way, they might have all been on the list today as some great turncoats to the American way of life. They may all have been executed. And that probably is the reason that some of the men who did not attend did not attend. For instance, John Hancock and Patrick Henry did not attend. Jefferson was out of the country at the time. Although he had warning that this was to take place, he chose not to be there. And so the idea may have been that some of these individuals saw perhaps the wrong in what these individuals were doing and chose to stay away purposely. But these individuals met at Constitution Hall in Philadelphia and began to work immediately on the Constitution of the United States. I'll give you some quotes here concerning what took place there. Madison said, quote, "I feel it a duty to express my profound and solemn conviction that there never was an assembly of men charged with a great and arduous trust who were more pure in their motives or more exclusively or anxiously devoted to the object committed to them to best secure the permanent liberty and happiness of their country." So when Madison wrote and his writings were published, he realized that the individuals that had met there had pure motivation. In other words, they were not there just for the simple task of overthrowing a country or producing a system of anarchy or anything. They wanted to form a republic that was strong. They saw basically what we discussed over the last several weeks, the inevitable, or the handwriting on the wall. America would not survive as a confederacy. She had to work out some problems. They had to learn, the several states had to learn to get along with one another. They had to learn to stop the bickering back and forth among themselves and the fighting that took place and the near wars that arose on several occasions because states disagreed with other states and each maintained their own sovereignty in the situation. And so they realized something had to be done. And their system was to totally abandon what was set up and to put together what they felt would best represent what our nation was about. We arrived at what we basically call the Constitution is a bundle of compromises. And it is amazing that we have the document in place that governs our nation, and it has done so as efficiently as it has for the last 200 years, considering the fact that it basically was a lot of compromises. It was not a master architect that drew up the Constitution. It was a group of men who got together, and some said, we want this, and others said, no, we don't want that, we want this. And when it was all finished, there was a bundle of compromises, is what amounted to our Constitution. We talked about some of those compromises, one of the most strategic being the Three-Fifths Compromise, and that being a situation that arose between the northern states, the southern states, over the issue of slavery. Slavery was an institution that was bittersweet to our nation even from its birth. Those men who realized that slavery was not the thing to be done, slavery basically has always been acknowledged as immoral. I don't know that anyone tried to defend the morality of it, the idea of owning another person. And even in some, perhaps maybe in some of the cases of southern plantation owners, that might be refutable. But for the most part, our nation has always considered slavery as something that was immoral. And even in the days of our forefathers here, which preceded or predated the revolution, or the I'm trying to think of the name of the war now, the Civil War, by 75 years, the handwriting was on the wall for slavery. I mentioned, and let me go through it briefly again today, and we'll go through it when we get to the Civil War, but oftentimes the craziest thing we can do is to try to interpret history by where we are or by what we see around us. And we try to put current trends. I don't know, some of the TV shows are absolutely insane, you know, especially the historical TV shows, because they're going back and they're trying to make contemporary issues, issues of 100 years ago. And, you know, it just wasn't that way. The issues of 100 years ago are not the issues of the day today. And to go back and make those issues is to distort history and to rewrite history, which again is one of the ideas that may be upon us, is to rewrite history in the light of what's going on today. However, slavery was a dead institution. I have the writings here of Thomas Jefferson, and he'll acknowledge the same, that slavery would not last, would not endure in the Republic of the United States. The problem was, how do you get away from it? How do you change it? And particularly much more difficult for the Southerners than the Northerners. The Northerners, obviously, because the first colonies in America, the oldest colonies in America, were established in the North. Slaves had been brought in, and slavery, matter of fact, one of the largest slave ports in America was up in New England, where the slaves were brought in. So, but what had happened is, over a period of years in the development of the colonies to the North had become more and more commercial, more and more industrial. That's the place where the manufacturing had taken place, and that time, while the southern colonies remained more agricultural. And when confronted with the issue of abolishing slavery, it was not as difficult for the North as it was for the South, because the North did not utilize, although Jefferson and Washington and the men who were integral in forming our republic, they owned slaves and they existed with slaves. They didn't have nearly as many as the Southerners had, on the plantations. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to justify slavery. I'm trying to get you to see the perspective that each one of those individual sections of the country looked at the situation that they were dealing with. And I mentioned, I think last week, the example would be if tomorrow Congress ruled all of a sudden that to require people to do manual labor of any kind was unconstitutional and illegal, what in the world would happen at General Motors and Ford and Chevrolet and Chrysler and all those companies next week? You see, the situation existed, and I believe it best be surmised by saying this, nobody really liked slavery. But they didn't have anything to option it out with. They didn't have anything to replace it with. Jefferson came up with a good plan, and Jefferson's plan was that each slave, as they were brought into this country at age 18, they would be free. And no one could own them again as a slave. They would earn their freedom at age 18, and slowly but surely we cease to bring in the slaves. Slaves born in a master's home could be utilized as slaves until they're age 18, then they were free. And the idea was that slowly but surely we'll move away from this thing of slavery. It was a good idea. It never was incorporated, and so it resulted in the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people because nobody was willing to listen until we basically just clashed heads. But when considering the rights of the states, the northern states had a different perspective than the southern states, as was reflected by the Three-Fifths Compromise. When it came to electing officials, remember that one part or one division of our government was proportionally elected. In other words, the larger states have more representatives in the House of Representatives. And so the southern states, they thought, boy, this is great. We want to count all of our slaves. When we get ready to send our representatives to this centralized government, we want to count our slaves, and therefore we'll boost our population numbers. We'll get to elect more representatives, so we'll have some real power in one branch of the government. And so the southerners were all for that. The northerners weren't real keen on that. On the other side of the coin, when it came to taxing the states by the federal government, the North said, you know, you Southerners have got a lot of slaves. You need to count them all. And therefore, the Northerners' idea was these Southerners are going to have to pay more taxes, and therefore they're going to share a greater part of the burden in governing the country. And, of course, the Southerners didn't like that one at all. And so what basically happened after the haggling back and forth was what was called the Three-Fifths Compromise. And that said that for purposes of taxation as well as elections and whatnot, three-fifths of the population of the slaves would be counted in every state. Now, you say, why is that necessary to teach that? Because it's interesting to show how our documents were conceived, how they came about. Just a process of one side against another until a plan was hammered out and came into existence. We talked about the Virginia plan proposed by Edmund Randolph. And his plan was that we have two houses in our governmental system, aside from the judiciary and aside from the executive. And those two houses, we call that a bicameral situation, but they were to be elected totally on a proportional basis. The big states liked that because they had more people, and with more people, again, they could stack the government in their favor. The small states didn't appreciate that at all. Another plan was the New Jersey plan, and the New Jersey plan called for a unicameral house, in other words, just one house to make the laws of the land, and that house was to be one that was elected totally on equal representation. In other words, each colony had the same number of representatives. The big states didn't like that. And so again, we have a compromise not only with the North and the South, but a compromise between big states and small states. And eventually our Constitution was hammered out through the process. When it was all finished, 39 of the 55 delegates signed the Constitution of the United States, which basically did absolutely nothing. The Constitution was a worthless piece of writing, had no power at all, because, again, the Constitutional Congress was there in violation of law anyway. They were not permitted to be doing what they were doing. And so, again, by signing the Constitution, an individual basically could have been putting his name to a treasonous document, a document that could be used to convict him of treason and even bring about his own death. 39 of the 55 signed. I have an interesting quote here that Franklin made. Madison said concerning Franklin, while the last members were signing, Dr. Franklin looking toward the president's chair, at the back of which a rising sun happened to be painted, observed to a few members near him that painters had found it difficult to distinguish in their art a rising from a setting sun. "I have," said he, often in the course of the session and of the vicissitudes of my hopes and fears as to its issue, looked at that behind the president without being able to tell whether it was rising or setting. But now at length I have the happiness to know that it is a rising and not a setting sun." And Franklin's idea was that our nation finally was getting something that could bring it to prosperity, that could hold it together. And so Franklin saw the picture behind the president there, not as one of a setting sun, but as one of a rising sun. So the Constitution is finished. 39 delegates sign it, and it is sent back to the states for their consideration. It is fixed with an idea that it becomes effective when 9 states have ratified it. It becomes effective for those states that have ratified it, meaning that if a state did not ratify it, then that state simply was excluded from the Union. In other words, they did not impose their powers. They did not say when 9 states ratify this document, then the other states must conform to its policies. They stated merely that when it is ratified, it becomes the law of those states that have ratified it. But it could not be an effective document until 9 states had ratified it. It sent back to the colonies. I was going to give you a little pop quiz this morning, see if you could remember the names of the 13 colonies. I won't do that because you might flunk. All right. But the colonies that existed at that time began to consider the document. They began to look at it, and what we have then is a division that arose in the country called the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist. And it was not some of the most prominent men represented both sides of the coin. Some of them took a moderate position. I think Jefferson's position is very moderate. I don't think he considered one way or the other. Patrick Henry was very, very, very anti-federalist and opposed to any type of a federal government. A federalist was an individual who advocated a strong centralized government to govern the affairs of the nation. An anti-federalist was one who opposed that. He was along the lines of the Confederacy that we just talked about. He was one who maintained that the states' rights should never be abolished or even threatened in any way, and so there was a controversy that arose. The first state to ratify the Constitution was Delaware. I think to this day their motto is the first state, something along that line. Delaware ratified, and then a number of states followed until 9 states had ratified the document, and I think New Hampshire being the 9th state to ratify the document. The problem was that of the 9 states that had ratified the document, the 2 largest states in the country had not ratified it, and those states being New York and Virginia. And both of those states having problems with the idea of states' rights. Do you sacrifice these rights? Do you give them to a strong federal government, or do you maintain them for yourselves? And 2 things came into play as a result of these strategies. Of course, with the New York situation, there was a book published called The Federalist Papers. How many of you ever heard of The Federalist Papers? All right. The Federalist Papers were, I think, 85, 86 essays that were written in favor of a federal government. And they were there. I think it's kind of interesting. We saw it on one of the tapes a couple years ago or a couple times ago when we were looking that dealt with the Federalist Paper being given to the Harvard Law class here in the last couple of years, required reading. And the professor passed out the Federalist Papers to all those incoming lawyers and legal minds and asked their opinion. And their opinion was, nobody can understand this. This is so complex that nobody could figure this out, at least not from their perspective as lawyers. And it was then that the teacher explained to them the reason they couldn't understand it is because basically the Federalist Papers were written for farmers and for storekeepers and shopkeepers of the 1700s. And they had such more intense understanding of governmental issues than lawyers do today. I guess it was to their discredit, but they couldn't understand the Federalist Papers. In all fairness, they are written a level or two above where you and I live today. I guess America's great ideal is that we are so much better off and so much more intelligent. And if that be true, it's kind of hard to explain why we can't even understand simple documents that were written 200 years ago as a way of explanation of our government. But they are rather difficult to understand, although they are understandable, perhaps not by all, but they are. And the Federalist Papers then became a defense of a federal government. And to this day, they stand. Most arguments you would hear from those who still desire a stronger federal government would be those given in the Federalist Papers. They have been the source of most all of that material. And so the New York controversy brought that about. The controversy in Virginia brought about another very interesting idea, and that was this. The Virginians, while opposed to a strong federal government, were opposed to a strong federal government because it did not specify the rights of the people. And we have always maintained the rights of the individual over the rights of the government. As far as maybe not said so much to this day and time, but being an American means I'm more important than the federal government is. And a lot of people have forsaken that. People say, well, you know, what about the government? I'm more important than the federal government is. The government does not exist but at my bidding. You see, that's called governed by the right of consent. I give them the right to make laws. Therefore, I'm the supreme power, not the government. And Americans have no reason to fear government. And if you fear government, it's because you've been intimidated into an idea that doesn't exist. We are the government. And our power is power of the voting booth and other places along that line, but we are the government. That's been the basic consensus from the very beginning, even more so in Virginia. Because Virginia said, hey, we've got this document called the Declaration of Independence, and now this new one called the Constitution. And in the Constitution, we deal with some things called inalienable rights. All men are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these, which is an interesting thought, if our framers of the Constitution said among these, then there must have been others they didn't specify. Among these are the right, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now, if among those are inalienable rights, which means no government gives you those rights, you have those rights. Inalienable means they can't be taken away, they weren't given to you. If among these, then who has the right to say what those other rights are? It's the people. It is the people who have the right to say, wait a minute, that's my inalienable right, and no one has the right to interfere with that right. Again, the Constitution gives power to the people. But Virginia said, well, it's not specific enough. We want to know what the rights are that the government can't touch. So there was a proclamation issued that called for a Bill of Rights to be added to the Constitution before Virginia ever would adopt it. And Virginia basically went ahead and voted and ratified the Constitution with that thought in mind. There was to be a Bill of Rights that specifically spelled out the rights that American citizens enjoy. Jefferson wrote, let me read to you, this is a rather old book. None of the new books have this in it. Strangely enough, I don't know why, if I can find it for you. It says, to the Constitution of the United States, he wrote to Dr. Priestley in 1802, I was in Europe when the Constitution was planned and never saw it till after it was established. On receiving it, I wrote strongly to Mr. Madison, urging the want of provision for the freedom of religion, freedom of the press, trial by jury, habeas corpus, substitution of militia for standing army. It was Jefferson that wanted militia in your Second Amendment rather than standing army, because a militia is individual citizens, not a federal military unit, and an express reservation to the states of all rights not specifically granted to the Union. He accordingly moved in the first session of Congress for these amendments, which were agreed to and ratified by the states as they now stand. This is all the hand I had in what related to the Constitution. It is certain that though written constitutions may be violated in moments of passion or delusion, yet they furnish a text to which those who are watchful may again rally to recall the people. They fix too for the people the principles of their political creed. So Jefferson had nothing to do with the Constitution of the United States other than he was an advocate of the Bill of Rights that were added to the Constitution of the United States. There are those that would kind of make you feel that the Bill of Rights was a second document that was added to. And while that is true, theoretically, it is not absolutely true. There were a number of states that would not have ratified this document had it not been for the call to place into the document the Bill of Rights. So while the Bill of Rights is a separate, it is certainly not a divided issue from the Constitution of the United States. It's an integral part of it. The colonies that signed, I'll give them to you here. Delaware signed first, Pennsylvania signed second, or ratified second, New Jersey ratified third, Georgia ratified fourth, Connecticut was fifth, Massachusetts was sixth, Maryland was seventh, looking here, South Carolina was eighth, and New Hampshire was the ninth. The next two states to ratify, of course, were Virginia and then New York. That left South Carolina and Rhode Island as not having ratified the Constitution. And what is interesting is it was not until 1789 that Rhode Island adopted, and as well as South Carolina, North Carolina adopting in November of 1789. These basically joined because the provision was put to them, you either ratify now or you exist as a separate country. And the fear of existing as a separate country was more than the states could overcome, and so they ratified and became part of the 13 states that made up our government. Our government became, as far as the Constitution was concerned, different than basically any other form of government that existed to that time. I don't know that there is at this point. I know that at the point that the documents were forged and our government came into existence, no government had ever been formed like that at all. Most governments come into existence by force, by overthrow, or just by lethargy among peoples. The American government came into existence by men sitting down across a table and arguing their differences, arriving at compromises, and agreeing to govern themselves by the outcome of their labor. Had never happened that way before. And basically what America became was a republic. The terms democracy and republic are a little bit... we talk about America being a democracy. In honesty, it is not a democracy. But when you say that, some people think you're a communist, but the truth is in the definition of the terms. The term of democracy does not apply to the United States of America in its completeness. You might call America an indirect democracy. That would be about as close as you could come. Democracy, I'll give you a Greek lesson this morning. I won't correct the Bible, but I'll correct, I won't even correct it. I'll just tell you what it means. Democracy, two Greek words, demos and kratos. And what it means is the rule of the people. The rule of the people. And you say, well, that's what we have in America. Not in the sense that those words imply. What those words imply, and in a democracy, the people are involved in making their own laws. They're involved in all their government on a personal level. You and I are not involved in our government on a personal level. You've never made a law in your life. You've never passed a law in your life. You have elected officials who pass those laws for you. All right? That's a republican form of government. A republican form of government acknowledges the fact that certain people have better abilities to govern than I do. And so I place them there and I allow them to govern me because they have ability. Now somebody said, well, that creates an aristocracy. And maybe it does. If you look at Washington, I'm not sure. Maybe it does create an aristocracy. However, that's the Republican form of government, and we have a Republican form of government. Now, don't confuse that with the political parties. Just understand the definitions. We have an indirect democracy in that we elect the officials that represent us. They are answerable to us, and we have the right to either re-elect or to eliminate their ability to govern our country by right of the voting booth. So we have a democracy in one sense, but not in the broad sense, not in the true sense. We are governed by, basically, I guess if you wanted to give it the terminology, it would be an indirect democratic republic. Indirectly democratic republic. And what that means, again, is that we elect people who then we elect them because of their qualifications, correct? We elect them because they're better qualified than we are to make our laws and to understand those laws. And we then, along the lines of the Republican philosophy, we place them in government to take care of things. So we are a democratic republic. That's the form of government that was arrived at by these individuals. Now, let me tell you a little bit about it. We'll go through it this morning. And again, you say, what's this got to do with the Bible? Well, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, maybe. First of all, we have a federal system. We abolished the system of individual states with all the powers, and we placed many of those powers at the control of a federal government. Some of those powers were turned over to the federal governments. Others specifically were maintained by the states. Now, what we have today is what we call a broadened understanding of government structure. That's what's given rise to big government. And I'm not really talking a political issue here. I think most Americans are opposed to big government, at least the size of what we have now. We are fast approaching the place where half the people in America work for the federal government. I think that's a little bigger than the framers of the Constitution intended it to be. There's a move to cut down on the size of government. Even the Vice President of the United States acknowledged that our government is out of control. We need to bring it back under the control of the people. And the idea was that the states forfeited some of their rights as states to the federal government, but they specifically maintained other rights. As a matter of fact, one of the provisions of the Constitution states that any law or any rights not granted to the federal government resides with, in other words, the federal government cannot usurp authority that was not given to it by the Constitution. The problem that has arisen and created what we deal with today is what has been called implied powers. In other words, while some powers were not specifically granted to the federal government, it has been decided that some powers were implied in that document. For instance, Congress never had the right, according to the Constitution, to create an Air Force. It had the right to create an army, but not the right to create an Air Force. And so what do? Does Congress have the right to create the United States Air Force or not? And the Supreme Court ruled in that sense that, yes, there is an implied power there, even though it's not specific. Who knew there's going to be an Air Force? So there is an implied power. You see how implied power comes about? An implied power in a lot of cases has been very necessary to the preservation of our country. While certain things may not be specifically stated, the Constitution, as understood by the Supreme Court, has given the federal government some implied powers. And so they have some powers beyond those that are specified in the Constitution, and that's not a violation of states' rights. However, those implied powers have gone on just a little bit too far, and we've got what we've got right now. Some of the states over the last few months have issued almost edicts to the federal government that says, hey, it's time to lay off. It's time to back away here. We've had enough of this, and it's time we got back to a constitutional form of government, and it's time we dropped the size of our federal government just a little bit. But suffice it to say that power was vested in the federal government as it was relinquished by the states. The states maintain some rights. Here's a list of some of the rights they maintain. Specifically, they maintain the right to local government. In other words, the federal government doesn't have the right to come in here and say, well, you have to put your signs 25 feet off the main road, and you can't put a lighted sign up, and you have to build this type of residential code and that type. The states maintain the rights to govern themselves locally, and the government did not have a right to interfere with that. Secondly, the states maintained the ability to keep their voting rights and requirements in place. Now, the federal government has exercised its powers in two or three cases where they granted suffrage to women and the rights to vote to slaves. And again, that's not a violation of that separation between federal and state power, but certainly brought more things into perspective for the states. The states were required to oblige the government in those issues. Number three, the state government maintained marriage and divorce documents and laws. They put those into place. Most of them now are non-existent, but I have what they call a minister's manual that I've had for a number of years, and basically was written to explain the various laws concerning marriage and divorce in the various states. And you know, you used to have to have a blood test, and you couldn't marry your fifth cousin or whatever it was. And basically, you can just about do anything you want to now. Those laws have all but been dropped, and but the state maintained that right. Also, the state maintained the right to education. And I guess this is probably the battleground that you'll see in the next decade in our country is who maintains education. The states reserve that right under the Constitution to educate their own children. And that is one that's up for grabs at this point. But there were some other powers that were not as important as these, but it was a division of powers. The government now had the power to tax, it had the power to raise an army, it had the power to carry on commercial trade and raise tariffs and that type of thing. It had the ability to regulate interstate commerce. And so the government was given a lot of power, necessary power, to continue the government of the United States. These individuals divided our government up into three branches. And I hope this doesn't sound too basic this morning. Hopefully you understand what your three branches of government are all about, and you should anyway. First of all, we have a legislative branch. The legislative branch has a specific job. Their specific job, and they have other jobs alongside of that we'll see in a minute, but their specific job is to make or enact the laws of the land. That's their job, and that would encompass even treaties and whatnot that are said to be the laws of the land. Congress has the function of making those laws that will govern you and I. We're up for a big election here, and again, we have the right to elect those who are going to make those laws for us. One of the things that disturbs most of us in America is apathy at the voting booth. People simply don't vote. And we like to complain, but we don't go vote. And, you know, if you don't exercise your right to vote, then how can you exercise your right to complain? Amen? That is rather difficult. But the second thing that's real sad is we don't know who to vote for. We don't know who to vote for when we go to vote. That's a sad situation. And you say, well, I like this guy, I like the way he looked on television. Well, that's kind of a dumb reason to vote for a guy. But you'd be amazed how many elections are determined by just such as that. As an American, you not only have rights, but you have obligations and you have responsibilities. It is your responsibility to understand what the candidates that are running for represent. And I would bet this morning, here we are close to an election, I would bet the majority of you have no idea what many of the candidates believe or stand for. And to that, I just say shame on you. How can you expect America ever to be anything more than it is when you have no idea who you're voting for or what you're voting for? Amen. You say, well, how do I find out? A phone call. Demand information. And some people vote a political party. America, the days of political parties seems to be diminishing. It's amazing how many candidates are running for political office and they have not bothered to list their political party on their placards. I mean, it's you say, what's going on? They're afraid to be identified with anybody right now, which is kind of good, I guess, because maybe it poses a break from the traditional ideas of political parties. But at the other hand, what do they believe? How do I know what they believe? How do I know what they adhere to? You need to find out. You need to find out. You need to make it your business to find. It is your responsibility to find out so that you can vote what your conscience dictates to you. So we have a legislative branch. The legislative branch divided into two houses of Congress. There is the Senate and there is the House of Representatives. The Senate was the division of the legislative branch, and the Senate is elected for a term of 6 years. When you elect a senator, the United States Senate, you elect him for a six-year term, and he is there to enact those laws. He is there basically on equal representation. In other words, each state gets how many senators? Two. Excellent. Y'all are smart. Know almost as much as the kids know. Each state gets two senators to represent them in Washington. In the state of Ohio, you have two. Metzenbaum and John Glenn. Very good. I was hoping somebody would know who they were. And those individuals are elected for six-year terms. One of those seats is up for grabs here because of the retirement of Metzenbaum, and so that's part of the election you're going to be facing. So you have two senators from each state. Each state has an equal representation in the United States Senate. Not any one state can maintain control of the Senate of the United States. You see that? Even big states have to limit themselves to two senators. Even rich states have to limit themselves to two senators. Everybody has equal representation. The House of Representatives, on the other hand, is what we call proportional representation. And individuals there are elected on the placing of congressional boundaries and congressional districts. And so a state may have two senators and may have dozens of representatives depending on the congressional districts and the lines that are drawn up. Those are proportionate. In other words, one representative for every so many thousand people goes to the House of Representatives in Washington. Because there are so many up there, their term is not a six-year term. How long is the term for a House of Representatives? 2 years. Every 2 years, the House of Representatives re-elects those that will do the work there in the House of Representatives. Legislation can be put on the floor or be brought to the floor in either house. And that legislation can be worked on and hammered out in either house, but it must then go to the other house for its approval. And before it can ever become law, it has to pass through both houses of Congress and then on to the President of the United States. So we have a legislative branch. They make the laws. Then we have an executive branch. Our executive branch, the specific job of the executive branch is to carry out the laws enacted, to see that those laws enacted are basically carried out. How does he do that? He has at his disposal the militias of the United States. He has at his disposal the Army of the United States. His job is to carry that. For instance, if we make a treaty, according to the Constitution of the United States, any treaty enacted by Congress becomes the law of the land. Whether the states want it or not, it is the law of the land. It is the President's job then to see that that treaty is carried out and enacted. Even if it means we have to invade a foreign power, that's his job. His job is to wield the sword, I guess, so to speak, and to see that the laws enacted by the legislative branch are put into play and carried out as they should be. And then we have the judicial form, or the judicial side of our government. The judicial side, specifically, the job of the judiciary is to determine cases of federal law, disputes arising from federal law, as well as the question of constitutionality. So that is the job of the judiciary. The Judiciary Act exists as the Supreme Court and then other federal courts on down through the United States of America. Three divisions of government. Why did they set those up that way? Well, first of all, their desire was to have strength in each of those areas, realizing that not one group or one individual can do all three without having, without finding themselves in what we would have to call a conflict of interest. They felt it better if there were a separation of powers, separate powers to govern the United States of America. That also proved or was there to maintain the idea that no one could gain control of the United States government. In other words, you've always got somebody there that, if Congress were to be corrupted and, nothing there but somebody who thought to bring down our country, we still have the judiciary and the executive to stand against that. Or if the executive were to become corrupted, we still have the legislative and the judiciary. Each one is there to maintain a separate check or balance on the other. And those checks and balances now become very important. Now, let me come back and again remind you what I've reminded you of several times. We take a lot of this for granted. We think, well, boy, 6 years, 2 years, this proportional and equal representation. You need to realize the individuals that put this together were taking a shot in the dark. They didn't know this was going to work. And they were doing the very best they could to try and protect the country that they were to defend or to represent from any type of threat, whether it be external or internal. And they did a reasonably remarkable job, because for 200 years, we've only needed to change our Constitution in a few areas. There have been relatively very few amendments to the Constitution of America in 200 years' time, considering the millions of people it represents. So the shot in the dark that these individuals took was remarkable, considering that there was no previous plan laid out for them to use. But they also built into the system what we call checks and balances, specific checks and balances. For instance, if Congress makes a law that no one likes, what recourse do we have? Well, we have two. Number one, the President of the United States can veto it. Number two, the Supreme Court of the United States can rule it unconstitutional. So each one has a check on the power of Congress. You see, Congress doesn't have just a license to write any kind of law that they like. The Supreme Court has to preside over it as well as the executive. Well, what if the President's just a stick in the mud and the Congress writes good legislation and he vetoes it? Well, with a two-third override, Congress can override the veto of the President of the United States. You see the checks that are built in there? No one can take the ball and run with it. It's got to be a team effort. Not only that, but the Supreme Court can declare the constitutionality, and then Congress has the power to impeach the President or a member of the Supreme Court. If there is graft or corruption involved, the Congress of the United States has the ability to impeach the President of the United States or a Supreme Court justice. And so they have some power. Well, now, who has power over the Congress? We the people do. We can vote to kick them out of office if we don't like what they're doing. So there are some powers here that are balanced out, some powers here that must work together. What about a Supreme Court justice? Who has control over them? The President nominates the Supreme Court justices, and Congress has the right to approve or disapprove that nomination, and they also have the right to impeach that Supreme Court justice. So there are checks and balances all the way around. And you say, how did they get to be there? Well, it's just planning to the specific, you know, we're going to do it this way. No, basically it was a bunch of compromises. It was a bunch of men who got together and said, I don't like your idea, here's what I think. Somebody else said, well, I don't like your idea because of this, and here's what I think. And when it was all said and done, this Constitution of the United States has literally been designated the bundle of compromises. That's all it was. But it has served as probably the most magnificent document that was ever produced, and it's governed our country effectively for over 200 years. You say, well, it was democracy that's done it. No, no. There have been other democracies that have come and gone since the United States existed. The French Revolution was supposedly a democratic revolution. And the people decided to kill everybody, basically, that was in power there. And everybody was executed at the guillotine. And we're going to have, liberty and fraternity and equality and all of that good stuff. You know, the government of France has changed its... I'm trying to think of the word. The way it looks. The way it functions. The government of France has changed several hundred times in the same time the United States has existed as we've existed. You look at the European nations and their government, basically some of them change as often as every 3 or 4 years. Not only do they elect a new ruler, they change their form of government. America's existed the way we are for 200 years. That's a testimony to what these individuals did. Now, why did it work? Well, was it democracy? No. Democracy has come and democracy is gone. I'll read you some articles here about what was done. One of the greatest ones that was ever written, I think, was the one written by Noah Webster. And I'll give you that one this morning as we close. And Noah Webster wrote in 1833. You wonder who Webster was? You ought to know who Webster is. How many of you know who Webster is? Oh, no. Well, if you don't know, look at the dictionary. All right. Noah Webster wrote the first, put together the first dictionary in the United States. His home, I think, is up at Greenfield Village. If you go there, you see where he lived and where he worked. But he wrote the first dictionary and compiled the words so that we could understand what they are. In 1833, which is about 35 years following this document called the Constitution, after it came into existence, he wrote this: "It is extremely important to our nation, in a political as well as religious view, that all possible authority and influence should be given to the Scriptures, for these furnish the best principles of civil liberty and the most effectual support of republican government. They teach the true principles of that equality of rights which belongs to every one of the human family, but only in consistency with a strict subordination to the magistrate and the law. The scriptures were intended by God to be the guide of human reason. The creator of man established the moral order of the universe, knowing that human reason, left without a divine guide or rule of action, would fill the world with disorder, crime, and misery. A great portion of mankind, ignorant of this guide or rejecting its authority, have verified the fact, and the history of 3,000 years is a tissue of proof that human reason, left to itself, can neither preserve morals nor give duration to a free government. Human reason has never been, and unquestionably never will be, a match for ambition, selfishness, and the other evil passions of man. On the other hand, opposed to the force of these passions, constitution and laws are generally found to be mere cobwebs and gossamer. The principles of all genuine liberty and of wise laws and administrations are to be drawn from the Bible and sustained by its authority. The man, therefore, who weakens or destroys the divine authority of that book may be accessory to all the public disorders which society is doomed to suffer. In my view, there are two powers only which are sufficient to control men and secure the rights of individuals and a peaceable administration. These are the combined force of religion and law, and the force of the fear of the bayonet. The Bible is the chief moral cause of all that is good and the best corrector of all that is evil in human society, the best book for regulating the temporal concerns of men, and the only book that can serve as an infallible guide to future felicity. Noah Webster wrote that. Noah Webster was a great statesman. Why did our government work? In 1832, Webster said further, quote, "Almost all civil liberty now enjoined in the world owes its origin to the principles of the Christian religion," end quote. Why did America work? America worked because America had a moral fiber. You know, there are a lot of ideas about why governments exist and why our government is so great. And today the idea seems to be that we're educated or we're wealthy or affluent. That's absurd. The reason our government has existed is because we had a moral fiber. And that moral fiber came from no other source than the Word of God. And even people, listen, I'm not saying everybody has to be what I am. But even people who didn't go to church had a moral fiber to them that came out of this book. There is a recognition of that fact, and there is today in some of our even public schools a drive to return some moral absolutes to the classroom. Listen, it was morality that caused the inhabitants of the United States, when the Constitution was ratified, to say, okay, we will allow that to be our government. I mean, suppose today we were to walk down to a bunch of teenagers and say, here's what our government's going to be. How many of you suppose are going to take that? None of them want any government at all. It is a natural thing for a natural human being to resist and rebel against any authority. That being the case of natural man, how do you explain the fact that natural man agreed to allow himself to be governed by a document that he didn't even write? The reason behind that is a moral value that was in the hearts of men that came out of this book. And as we get away, according to Webster himself, if we get away from this book, we're going to bring on ourselves crime and violence, which is exactly where we are today. So, the thing that has caused our government to exist for 200 years is a moral fiber. It's amazing to me that someone is at work to make an enemy out of religion and the government. The reason that the separation between church and state exists is because both must be free and independent from the other to work together to give the strength to this nation. And when you eliminate one, the other will fall of necessity. When you eliminate religion, government will not stand. You say, what's your proof? Look around the world. When you eliminate government, religion cannot exist. What's your proof? Look at all the religious systems around the world that govern the minds of men. There's a check and balance. All right, I was going to read you some things Jefferson said this morning. I think I'll wait and read them to you next week. There are some interesting thoughts that Jefferson had that you might not believe that he had. But Jefferson was opposed to a number of things. Jefferson was opposed to the judiciary system in the United States government. Jefferson did not believe in a Supreme Court.